Accession number 30279, Reel 7.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with Ross Bradbury in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 17th of the 10th, 2007, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Can we talk about how your experience of seeing these, or seeing what war is about, how did that affect a young bloke?
Oh, well, obviously it's quite a shock when you you see several bodies around without heads on and blood everywhere and a state of confusion that you have no control over, which was quite a worry, which we obviously reported and wanted to get some control over that state of flux, which occurs when the local population knows better than you do where the enemy is, because the enemy about this stage of the war was they weren't standing and fighting. All they wanted to do is to get out, and the Japanese had a fear of their heads being lopped off because they don't go to heaven. And so as slowly the confusion settled down, we had minimal first aid gear that we carried, but we did patch up a couple of young lads that had been hit by parangs. Now, mark you, most of them were wounded were Chinese, which again we wanted to be able to see if we could get control over that when we went into other towns, or as we call them, garrisons, but they were old trading towns pre-war. So there had been troops being trained back at headquarters. When I say troops, they were natives, and some of these natives were what they call heroic rangers, and they were a police force pre-war, and they were very disciplined natives, mainly Iban and Dayak. And we were getting a few more of these guys coming into the more active side after they had training, freshening up, I suppose, because all they did when the Japs arrived, they just threw the uniforms away and shot into the jungle. So anyway, and they wanted to come back and obviously do a job, and they get rid of the Japanese. So once there was control done, these other forces came in. That was our job was over. So we went back to headquarters for our next movement, which was the next major town down was Canaut, a reasonable sized trading town pre-war. Had somewhere in the vicinity maybe of a couple of hundred Japanese garrison, and obviously we weren't about to take them on, but we were going to make it uncomfortable for them. So, and at the same time, the party leader, Major Soshin, wanted some further intelligence. So we, Captain Carney and four of us and some of these trained Dayak, Ivan I was talking about, we bypassed Canaut and went down to a place that was known pre-war called Kids Estate, and that was like a market garden. Now, They had Japanese down there, one in control of this area, because it supplied the garrison at Cebu, which was maybe, we didn't quite know, but we estimated probably a couple of thousand Japanese down there, give or take. And the thought was that we could grab the commanding officer and get him back to Kaput, and then possibly fly him out to Labourne for interrogation. We successfully skirted around and then paddled down, and then there was a, we sent a couple of our natives in. Obviously they're not in uniform or anything, they're just in their normal native dress, and we rounded up the he was a major actually, and that was his job with a few others, and then there was a firefight and there was several Japanese killed. However, we achieved our objective. We captured this fellow, and so we got a prow and three or four paddlers and one of our boys and the Japanese officer were going to paddle up river.
What was it like to be involved in a firefight?
Well, it's a bit tricky because normally, sort of in the jungle, it's very hard to find out where exactly, when you only just sort of break into a place, to find out where the actual enemy is till you hear a few shots. Because of our objectives, we were only a very small force, we didn't want to expose ourselves at all. So, in other words, we could make ourselves scarce quite easy, because there was only three or four of us, but the best of times. And which we learnt later, because away went the prow. And about halfway up there, he dived overboard. Committed Harry Carey. Never seen again, because once you go into the Rajan River, as I said, it's full of crocodiles and it flows around about three or four knots. So all that waste of effort, and so that was that. We assembled back at headquarters, and by this time we thought we'd stir up Kanawha, and I think Captain Carney went back to Labourne for some meetings and what have you, or forward planning, you might say. So we took a small patrol down and again bypassed Kanawha, and thought we'd shoot their supply launch up. And see, they only travel at night now, because obviously the Allies control the air, and they could only travel on one side of the Rajang River, because you couldn't travel up the middle of the river because of the tide, and the tide might be running about three or four knots in the middle of the river. So we dug a weapon pit and put a heavy machine gun and a mortar and a couple of other and small firearms, and waited for the launch to come. And we had some of these pre-war Dyke and Ebans with us, because they thought it was wonderful, right? Have a shot at the Japanese after being persecuted for four years, and sure enough, we heard the launch coming. We're on the downside, call it, of canal. So it's Cebu and a few others, and then canal. And so we're on the downside. So as the launch comes up, and it comes abreast of us, we open fire. Send up a flare, and there's an awful lot of firing goes on. And of course, immediately, he spins around, heads toward the middle of the river. And so what effect we had, or what casualties we had, we wouldn't have the faintest idea, because he disappears downstream and, you know, never to return. Now, this is quite an interesting part of your experiences. So we followed up and got our gear, and we had a chat, because we've always... some of these guys speak a little English, but we generally have an interpreter who speaks fluent, like, or Ivan. And he said, well, you know, if we go inland for about half an hour or so, there will be a little camp on there. And sure enough, it was a bit airy, you know, walking through pitch black at night. And anyway, we arrived there, and there's a little fire going and what have you. And out of the gloom of this little camp on comes a Chinese. And to me, as a young lad, he looked about 100. And he threw his arms up, and he come in there, welcome. So yeah, he showed us in and sit down, and great hospitality. And through our interpreter, of course, he spoke fluent Chinese, so they're all chatting away. And he tells them, you know, what we're up to, because he had no idea we're going to appear out of the night at his little camp on. And anyway, he goes to a cupboard somewhere and comes out, and he holds up a bottle of cognac. And he said to the interpreter, he said, I've been saving this for the first white man that came through my door. So we sat down, and all glass eats, and toasted each other till there was nothing left in the bottle. So we slept pretty well, I can tell you. But it was quite an experience.
Had the training that you've been given really prepared you for this experience? You talk about the firefight and the attempt to capture this jet.
I suppose the firefight, but...
What's the difference when you're actually getting shot at with real bullets? You know, where you know that these people are actually... Yeah. Properly out there to kill you.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's what I was about to say. I mean, it's not like doing ordinary ambushes and with dummy cartridges and things like that. But these are dinkum, so they're going to kill you if you let them.
So how does your training come into play? People talk of this sort of almost automatic response.
Well, yes, in one way, and as I kept on saying, that we never tried to get ourselves in a position that we would be, you know, sort of the enemy firing at us and we're firing at them, you know, more or less point blank. We're always sort of hit and run. So we had the element of surprise, you might say. So the following morning, I suppose we might have had a little bit of a sort of headache, but it was wonderful. We left our wonderful Chinese host and back to report what had happened. And of course, though we didn't know what happened to the launch, apart from obviously it had quite a decent lot of firefight whizzing around it. Then we got a, not us, but the headquarters got a got a message through. It's quite amazing how we had wireless, pedal wireless and what have you, but the natives were better than us. They had an amazing sort of telegraph.
Bush telegraph.
Bush telegraph, exactly. Exaggerated to hell, I might add, but still, it was really dink and bow. But you always divide the numbers by quite a number. But and by this time, of course, the headquarters and everyone, they were preparing with other troops that I was telling you about. They were all getting ready to go down to Kanawha, and the message came back, they're gone. So, shooting the launch up and a few other things, they decided to get out. So, we got down there as fast as we could because we didn't want any more problem like we had in Song. And there was a fair number of us this time. So we're just getting established there and looking around to see if there's any booby traps and what have you. And then our SIG got a message from up at headquarters saying that they couldn't cancel the RAF and they're going to staff the place and at 0300 or something, in the afternoon, 1500 or something. And so Dave Carney, that's who's in charge of the, he got the native boys to look around and they found a lot of old planks. So district officers, which the Japs used as their sort of headquarters, there was quite a nice, like a parade ground, you could call it. So they, with the aid of the natives, again gave the good old Oz signal. He made a big Z, he made an Oz, and the usual Australian expression, fuck off. And then we did too, because we were going to stay there in case all this didn't work out. So we shot through and into the jungle for a while, and the next thing, we could hear the RAF coming, and they swooped over and gave a couple of times around, and I believe we heard later they took photographs of this rather crude signal we had on the ground. At any rate, they didn't staff the place, which was great, otherwise they would have, would have wrecked the damn place. So all went back to normal, and so Kanawha was taken, Kapit headquarters came down and established themselves there. So they were getting a bit closer to the whole, to Cebu, the main garrison for the Japanese in Samut 3, or in the old days called Division 3.
In relation to your experience, here you're actually having an opportunity of contact with the enemy. How are you finding the experience? How are you coping with this experience?
Well, we're trying to sort of contact them, you might say, but we're not really seeing them in numbers because they are moving. And as I said, they got out of Song at night time. They did exactly the same thing at Kanawha, and headed down river. Possibly all to, because there'd been a firefight at the Kids, which was between Canal and Cebu, so they didn't really know where the opposition, you might say, or the allies were. But and of course their numbers were quite extraordinary. They found out later on after the war. I think they ranked us, or numbered us around about over 2,000. And most of the time, when we did these raids, there was only about five of us. And natives, of course, yeah. But now, while all this was going on, which we didn't know about, but heard later, that both the Sochin and another couple of officers had been flown out to Labuan, and there was a talk about what they could do about the both civilian and army POWs, all at Kuching, which was the capital of Sarawak in Division 1. And of course there's quite a big established force down there, and I'm not too certain how many civilians, but there are quite a number of mixed bag of all types of allied servicemen in the bag down there. So they came back and then they thought, now we will send a small group down there to the 2nd Division, place, and that was the main town there, or garrison, or whatever you like to call it, was a place called Samangan. So once again, there was Dave Carney and our little group. So we paddled up the... We had no problems what we could gather from the natives between our objective to get close to Samangan and where we were down at Kanawa. So we paddled up the Kanawa Sungai, as they call it, stream, till we ran out of water. Now, we must have looked pretty comical, because we've got our carriers with us, and then we've got some Sarawak rangers, not in uniform or anything, and the carriers, of course, they've got food, because we're obviously we're going to be on the march for about, or the straggle, if you like to call it. We're going to be at least a week or more to get over where we want to get to. And they've got their rice all done up in banana leaves. They've got chooks in ratang carriers. And they've even got a pig with his legs tied on a pole, upside down. So it's all right while we're in the prows, but when we run out of water, we've got to walk. And to get over this mountain range in the 2nd Division is about, I think from memory, it was 2,300 feet. So it was a fair bit of climbing, I can tell you. And they've got a sense of humour, these guys. We had a rest halfway up, getting up this damn mountain range, and they're all sitting down, and next thing they all burst out laughing. Now, you can imagine being completely in the middle of nowhere, just surrounded by a jungle, no one would have the faintest idea where you were, and suddenly they're all laughing. So we said to the interpreter, what are they laughing about? And one of them said, "Pity this pig hasn't got wings that could fly." Yeah. And of course, you know, quite a few of them have had education and what have you, so they've learnt that somewhere from the days that the Brits were there. Anyway, at any rate, we finally got over this the crest of the mountain range. And another extraordinary thing you find in the jungle, that of course once you go over the other side, that's where the sungi starts, or they call it the ulu, right at the top end of a major stream. It will turn into a river in the end. And there's a couple of prows. Still don't know how they were there, but they were there. So away we went. We then paddled down till we got to a place called Batong, which was not all that far from, about a day's march, I suppose, to Semangan. And so then our party leader decided to send in some natives with one of our guys to do a recce. So they went in to have a look, and because they didn't know exactly what the strength of this place was. And it appeared that when they got there, they just, whether they had a bit of information like intelligence from maybe friendly natives, who knows. Anyway, when they got there, they could see that about three or four, and they were officers, coming out of the old ex-district officer's house, which they used as headquarters, to get into a type of launch, probably a fishing craft, to obviously go downriver. So the Frerick Rangers weren't going to let them go, so there was a fight. There was a firefight. And of course they didn't have the faintest idea that there was any armed troops, enemy troops around, as far as they were concerned. So I think a couple were killed and the rest were captured. Now they were all officers. And it appeared that they came up from Kuching to Semangan, and there's a couple of Kempe ties. So when it all settled down, they were put into the Kubu, the jail, and we more or less, there wasn't the problem that we had prior to that with the natives, you know, sort of looting and carry on. There was a little bit more control there. Our SIG radioed headquarters back at Kanaut that we were there, and then they told us that they dropped a bomb.